From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. White supremacists are marching in several cities. How should we respond?
And the reason I feel uncomfortable condemning the Klan types is they're almost the poorest of the poor. They're the forgotten Americans.
That's Ambassador Andrew Young speaking on NBC's Meet the Press. We get reactions to his remarks from other Georgians this hour. First, though, we heard this week from an Atlanta resident who wants to rename Confederate Avenue.
The reason I want to change the street name is that I don't think that there's room on a street sign to provide the context necessary.
That's Atlanta resident Joe Thomas. Here are your first thoughts.
This is Alan Doyle from East Atlanta Village. And I was thinking if Confederate Avenue were to be changed in its name, perhaps it could be changed to Compassion Avenue. There is no other Compassion Avenue in the United States, as near as I can tell.
We'd love to get your thoughts and suggestions. You can call us like Alan did at 404-500-9457. We're also on the Twitter. It's at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Earlier this month, Morris Publishing sold 11 Southeastern daily newspapers to Gatehouse Media. Those papers include the Augusta Chronicle, the Savannah Morning News, and the Athens Banner Herald. Stephen Wade is president of the Augusta Chronicle, and he said of the sale, quote, "Gatehouse is committed to the communities it serves. Augusta gets the benefit of having the resources available from a large national company while continuing to have the guidance and love from the Morris family that they have exhibited for nearly 90 years," end quote. With me now to talk about the sale is Carolyn Carlson, a professor of communications and media at Kennesaw State University. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning.
And also with us is Phil Kent, CEO of Insider Advantage and former editor of the Augusta Chronicle. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Celeste.
So there's sort of two separate issues here, right? There's the financial picture of what caused the sale to occur. And then there's the issue of how does a local paper best serve its community? So let's start with the financial picture. And Carolyn, maybe you talk about what sort of caused this sale.
Well, ever since the internet started carrying the news, all the newspaper industry throughout the country, throughout the world, has been shrinking and having financial difficulties. The Morris Papers were the last family-owned newspaper chain in Georgia still in existence. All the rest of the family-owned newspapers, at least the dailies, had been sold already to big chains. It seems like the only way to survive is as a big chain where you have economies of scale that keep things affordable.
And indeed, there has been record subscriptions numbers to news or outlets since the last year's election. But as you suggest, they've often been to things like the New York Times or the New Yorker or the Atlantic. So, Phil, what kind of publishers was the Morris Company and the Morris family?
Well, I worked for Billy Morris, who continues to be the publisher of the Augusta Chronicle, even though the sale is going through, for over 26 years. And so I had an intimate knowledge of the operations. And my friend Carolyn is right. You've got to redo and relook at a business model. Just to give you a quick tip, the sale of the Morris papers to Gatehouse was $120 million, and that included dozens of publications and the 11 dailies. And to give you some context, in 1984, when Billy Morris bought the Jacksonville paper, that was $200 million. So you can see what's going on in the industry. But I always enjoyed a local owner. Why? Because you could always know what was going on, and the owner knew about it rather than some faraway person. He was a watchdog journalist. I have to pay a quick tribute to the Morris family. As was pointed out, it's been about 90 years, a great journalistic tradition. We called for the resignation of district attorneys and without fear or favor, politicians. We had a very lively watchdog editorial page. I hope that somewhat continues. When I spoke with Billy Morris just before the sale, he thought it was a good fit with Gatehouse and that watchdog journalism would continue.
Well, we have a statement from Billy Morris, again, chairman of Morris Communications. He says, quote, "Since 1929, the Morris family has had a great love and passion for journalism and the communities they serve. However, every newspaper company in America is battling trends and redirected advertising dollars, so it's necessary for newspapers to be part of a large newspaper group to build and maintain the necessary resources to compete. And that brings us back to you, Carolyn, because is this nothing to see here? Or is, as journalists and as American citizens, is there a worrying trend when we lose locally owned newspapers and they go to nationally owned conglomerates?
The thing you got to remember is that somebody has to produce the news for all these internet news sites. People seem to forget that there has to be reporters somewhere, and most of the content providers for all these internet news services are these local newspapers, and they have to be supported somehow. And so it's important that they continue to survive. And if the best way for them to survive is for them to be in companies that like Gatehouse that has 550 newspapers, then I'm all for it, because we need to keep these papers alive. The Augusta Chronicle dates back to 1820. I mean, this is important for the community to have this newspaper and the resources, even though they're going to be reduced, to have these resources in the community.
Speaking of them being reduced, let's hear this comment from UJ journalism professor Barry Hollander. He's talking about the reputation that Gatehouse has when it purchases papers.
They are known for buying up properties and trying to milk them for value by making cuts. But the Morris newspapers, however, there's not a lot left to milk. The cuts have been so dramatic at all the Morris newspapers. The newsrooms are already shrunk and somewhat demoralized.
If you're joining me just now, I'm speaking with Carolyn Carlson, professor of communication and media at Kennesaw State, and Phil Kent, CEO of Insider Advantage. And this is kind of the question, isn't it, Phil? Because in order to make these newspapers profitable, oftentimes what happens is they fire a lot of local reporters. They start printing op-eds. They increase the number of ads. And you'll get AP, Associated Press, articles that come from all over the place. But you're not getting that local reporting anymore. What are your concerns about that?
Well, you've just encapsulated it. That is the big concern about the local reporting. And I do agree with my colleague, Carolyn, about you need still reporters at the local level. That's how you're still going to be making some money. And in Georgia, if you've got the legal ads, that always helps a publication too. And you still need the content, as has been pointed out. And so, yes, there'll be cuts. Yes, there'll be cuts in your local and state reportage, which will be sad. But the papers are going to keep going, because local is where the action is. And if they can keep that going, that's good.
So let's hear one more comment from Barry Hollander, again, a UGA professor of journalism, and he's talking about editorial control over the papers.
On the opinion page side in Athens, the Athens Banner-Herald or Savannah or Augusta, you're not going to see that much difference in terms of who they may endorse for a race or the institutional opinion about some issue.
Carolyn, some people have expressed concern over what may happen with a change of ownership. How do you respond to that? How much change may there be?
Well, first of all, I think the Morris Corporation was faced with the issue of shutting down the newspapers or selling them. So you have to think, at least we have the newspapers.
You're saying lesser of two evils?
Exactly.
Maybe.
Because a lot of newspapers are shutting down. So at least we still have the newspapers. As far as the editorial decisions, I think that with William Morris continuing as publisher, you aren't going to see a lot of change.
Yes, Celeste, very quickly. It was interesting, in the terms of the sale, Billy Morris is going to control the editorial page policy of the three Georgia papers, which is center-right, so nothing much will change.
So then, in the minutes that we have left, Carolyn, can we talk a little bit about this problem that we're in when it comes to local reporting? Because as you, the two of you have laid it out, the local reporting, actual reporters in the city that's being written about, is crucial, right?
Yes.
Fair.
And in fact, the AP copy that they get comes from local reporters. You have to have, if the AP didn't have stories coming in from all these local newspapers, the AP wouldn't have any copy. I mean, they have, the AP, I used to work for the AP. The AP has some news writers, of course, but most of the copy that comes out of the AP is originated with local newspapers. So there has to be some source, somebody on the ground doing the reporting, or there's not going to be any news eventually.
So Phil, this is an issue because as I mentioned, things like the New York Times subscription went up 10 times, but that has not been seen in local areas. Any ideas on how we fix that?
Well, I think digital is where the action is. And so if you can marry your digital products with your print product, and
how do you make people pay for stuff they find on the internet?
That's where we go back to our local discussion.
Yeah.
If you can still do something in Athens and in Augusta and Savannah that people want to know in those areas, you still got an edge over everybody else in that vast world of journalism.
You mean because it's local?
Because
it's
local.
And you're the only game
in
town.
And you can put it behind a paywall and make it interesting and have a snappy headline just like they taught us in journalism school.
Yeah. It's called hyperlocal nowadays. The hyperlocal websites are really the only ones that have a chance of getting money from people who want to read local news.
Really, if because it's nowhere else.
Exactly.
The New York Times story you can find also in the Washington Post and the LA
Times.
Right,
but you can't find anything in Decatur about Decatur news except for a hyperlocal website focusing on Decatur news.
Okay, so we need to put this out to our listeners. What are your news subscriptions? Are there these local sources? Do you pay for local news, or are you basically subscribing to American Conservative and The New Yorker, et cetera, et cetera? Tell us what you subscribe to, if anything. Our number is 404-500-9457, or you can tweet us at OST Talk. We have about a couple minutes left. It sounds, Carolyn, like you feel there's nothing to be concerned about over the sale of the Morris papers.
Well, I think there is going to be some shrinkage mostly on the business side, because like Phil says, the newsrooms are pretty shrunk as it is.
Yeah.
But there is going to be some cutting back. Gateway is indeed known for doing that. But I think that the newspapers themselves will continue, and the communities should be grateful for that.
And it's Gatehouse.
Gatehouse, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Phil, also, do you agree that there's mostly nothing to worry about?
I don't think there's that much to worry about. You're still going to have some local products in those three Georgia cities, for example, and on the rest of the properties. Now, what's going to happen in the next 10 years? Everything is changing so fast, as we just talked about. Digital is where the action is. You're going to really scale back the local print product.
Do you still subscribe to the Augusta Chronicle?
I look at it online, but I'll tell you what, and I publish a magazine, full disclosure,
yeah.
Magazines are where the action is if you have a niche publication, and that helps with the print product.
Because you made a gesture that made it look like you were agreeing, Carolyn.
I agree.
Magazines are the way to go.
That's what I teach my students at Kennesaw State. Magazines, if you want to go into print, you want to go into magazines.
Do you subscribe to a local paper?
I do. I subscribe to the three.
Three local papers. Carolyn Carlson, Kennesaw State Professor of Communications and Media and educator of future journalists, maybe in print. We also heard from Phil Kent, who's CEO of Insider Advantage and former editor at the Augusta Chronicle. Phil and Carolyn, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just ahead, a lot of people felt betrayed by news out of Trader Joe's this month. First, though, reactions to a controversial interview with Atlanta's own ambassador, Andrew Young. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This past weekend, former Atlanta mayor and UN ambassador Andrew Young was on NBC's Meet the Press with Chuck Todd. Ambassador Young was criticized by some civil rights activists because of his comments, like this one.
And the reason I feel uncomfortable condemning the Klan types is they're almost the poorest of the poor. They're the forgotten Americans. They have been used and abused and neglected. Instead of giving them affordable health care, they give them black lung jobs, and they're happy. And that just doesn't make sense in today's world. They see progress in the black community and on television and everywhere else, and they don't share it.
Ambassador Young went on to criticize some black activist groups.
Black well, they call themselves militants, but they're not militant. They're chicken. We never tried to take advantage of anybody else. Our job was not to put down white people. Our job was to lift everybody up together, to come so that we would learn to live together as brothers and sisters rather than perish together as fools.
We asked some local Atlanta activists for their thoughts on Ambassador Young's comments. Here is LGBT activist Monica Helms.
I have a lot of respect for Andrew Young, but I think in this particular case, he's off base, way off base. Most of the Klan's members, even historically in the past, have been richer white people, not necessarily the poor. The poor white people are usually can't spend time to take advantage of all these things, to go to these Klan meetings. It's mostly the rich people that can do this. So I don't think he seems to have a handle on this. For all these years, he must have lost something about it. If we sit back and not blame the Klan, then we're missing an important part of our history. We need to get rid of white supremacists, neo-Nazis, the Klan. They're all the same kind of people. They're very hateful. And that hate goes not only to African-Americans and Latinos. It goes to gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans people. It goes to everybody.
That was local activist Monica Helms. Reverend Gerald Durley is a longtime faith and civil rights leader in Georgia. He walked with Andrew Young during the civil rights movement in the 1960s. Here are his thoughts.
The remarks that Ambassador Andrew Young made on Meet the Press are not atypical from Ambassador Young. He has always been one who has always tried to look at how do we come together. He has always been a reconciler. So when his remarks were made, I listened to them. At points, I might have disagreed because of I'm so intentionally involved in today's issues. But when he talked about poverty versus race and some of the disparaging issues that have faced those in the Klan, Andy has always raised issues like that to make us think and to make us begin to possibly look at different strategies that we could use. Just is absolute confrontation the best way to do this, or do we try to, as he would always say, put our feet in other people's shoes and to walk a mile in their shoes? And I've always been one to try to address issues head on, but all of us have always appreciated his thoughtfulness when he was mayor, when he was ambassador, and even in this particular instance, to think about how do we look at what has created this situation and what is the best strategy to get out. So I understand that that's who he is, that's who he has always been, and I appreciate the consistency of keeping our heads a little level, because sometimes we can miss both sides of the particular issue.
That was local faith leader Reverend Gerald Durley. Orinike Oduleye is executive director of Creative Currents in Atlanta. This is her reaction.
I fully understood where he was coming from, and there is truth in his statement. I don't think it's the complete and complex truth. I think that, like our armed forces, absolutely, the people who are the foot soldiers of the neo-Nazi, of the Ku Klux Klan, of the alt-right movement are definitely largely poorer, less educated people. But just like in our armed forces, you go up the ranks and you're going to find people of all educational backgrounds and economic backgrounds. I feel as though the group that he's talking about has been manipulated since the beginning of the idea of race to serve the purpose of those that have more education and more economic background. But the movement in itself of white supremacy is filled with everybody from the smallest to the largest. They are absolutely some poor and uneducated, but they're also teachers, doctors, lawyers, politicians. They are the consultants to our president. And I think we have to keep that in mind always so that we are making sure that we're rooting out the roots of white supremacy in all of the different spheres of our society that we find it in. It's not just in rural trailer parks. It's also in our laws. It's also in our politics. It's also in our communities and our schools. And so we can't scapegoat one group and say that they are the large, you know, part of the white supremacy movement, because that's not true.
That's Creative Currents Executive Director Orenike Odelege. If you have thoughts on Andrew Young's Meet the Press interview, we'd love to hear them. Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457 or post to social media. We're on Facebook and Twitter. It's been a long week. It seems forever since the solar eclipse, right? We talked about that. We talked about true Southern identity this week. We read a few comics. So as we do every Friday, it's time to take a breath. We brought a group of smart people together. We're going to kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It is time for The Break Room.
First of all, I don't think it's just getting rid of the mountain. I think there has to be a telling of our history in the artifacts that are displayed out at Stone Mountain.
Another answer could have been dynamite.
That'll work too.
Afghanistan is a total and complete disaster. What are we doing?
Hey, what the? My retirement, Greece! No!
Joining us in the break room, Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent. Eric Siegel is constitutional law professor at Georgia State University. Roxanne Donovan, professor of psychology at Kennesaw State University. And Greg Williams, host of the conservative radio show Greg's List and a mortgage banker. Welcome, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
There's always a risk when you bring a psychology professor that she's just going to be like, you all are crazy.
She's writing down notes already on us.
I'm doing it right now.
She's diagnosing us right now. All right, so let's talk about retirement. First of all, retirement isn't for everybody.
Hey, buddy. When'd you get in? What are you doing here? Told you I was retiring. I moved in next door. Kramer, you can't live down here. This is where people come to die.
Aretha Franklin has big retirement plans. She plans to move back to her hometown of Detroit, open a fabulous nightclub, and then sometimes step out of retirement just to sing here and there. So my question is, what is your dream retirement plan? Let's say money is no object. What would you do?
Travel around
the whole time.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, no, I would travel around the world for a couple of years, and then I would retire to my lovely homes, where I would have one on the beach.
Homes. Yeah.
One in the mountains, probably one in New York. And one here.
Well,
in
we have a mortgage banker here.
Yeah, I was about to say, here's my card.
Greg, what would you do? Dream retirement?
Yeah, I would definitely move to the beach somewhere. As y'all may know, my wife is from Ecuador, and if money is no object, then it doesn't really matter where I live. But we would very likely go move to a tropical location, and I would have all the electronics in the world, so I could keep up with the rest of the world, but I could also unplug if necessary.
Caribbean.
So you'd be with me
the whole time, yeah. The two of you could argue
the
forever
and
ever.
The odd couple.
not with Greg.
Oh, dear God. I was going to say the Caribbean, but now I'm going to change my answer. But I've given this way too much thought. I want to live in a tiny house on the beach in the Caribbean, because I'm from the Caribbean. And I want to write. I'm with Kathy. I want to write about things that I love. And I don't want to be that connected to the world. I want to live.
Well, how are we going to read your stuff if you're not connected?
Well, I'll get on enough to blast it out, and then I'm turning it off.
Carve it into slates and then send them off to the publisher. Okay.
Get out of my head.
Let's get serious here. All right. The ACLU has brought lawsuits for decades in order to ensure the rights of pretty much everybody, and that includes the KKK and other hate groups, protecting their rights to protest. But now the American Civil Liberties Union has changed its tune. It says it will no longer defend the rights of those to protest who insist on protesting while armed. Let's go to you first, Eric. Do you think this is a good idea?
I think it's a necessary idea. We all have the right to peacefully protest. None of us have the right to peacefully protest with guns, and especially if the town, village, or city knows that two groups are going to show up and they're going to scream at each other. They are completely within their First Amendment rights to say, you can show up, you can protest, but all weapons have to be left at home. And let me just say, there is no serious Second Amendment argument to the contrary.
Greg?
Well, counterpoint,
now
right?
Now that you mentioned it.
Well, I mean, if you look at it, the ACLU is actually exhibiting and demonstrating their freedom of speech, their freedom to act. They're engaging in their First Amendment right to not protect this. And obviously, I think with the rhetoric so heated on both sides, with the neo-Nazis rising up and also the Antifa and the alt-left, it's just a powder keg right now. And I don't think any of these demonstrations anybody should go unarmed to these demonstrations. We're just too close to a brinksmanship and too much of a pushing point right now that it's a real
risk. And it's often law enforcement that asks protesters not to be armed. Roxanne, what do you think?
I think armed protesters reduce the free speech of those who don't have guns. So I don't want the Second Amendment right to trump the First Amendment right.
So I think this is a tough call.
What?
Because I don't believe in people being armed at protests. But on the other hand, I believe in supporting free speech, obviously. So, but there are time, place, and manner restrictions. Free speech is never, it's never total.
It's not unlimited.
Absolutely.
People think free speech
especially
is unlimited.
Especially if it's not a gun-related protest, right? If you're protesting something that's not related to the Second Amendment, then can't you talk without having to be armed?
I also said that I was on a show yesterday with David Cole, who's the legal director of the ACLU, was talking about how in 1934, when the ACLU first began to defend the Nazis, 1934, right to speak, their official first idea was you can speak, but you got to leave your guns at home. And
yes.
That just makes sense.
Although, if we went back to all those old Western movies, nobody would be able to talk.
Like
they
were always Tombstone would be a silent movie.
It would. There would be no talking. Sorry, Kathy, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Kathy.
No.
Are you done?
Also, the free speech doesn't guarantee the right to incite violence, quote unquote, is the word. And so if you've got guns, that can be said that is
an
part
incitement.
Of that. Right.
Okay. So let's move on to something even less appetizing. Cool. We all like cool, right? That's what the air conditioner is for. Cold? No.
I can't feel my fingers anymore. They're numb.
Books and websites and probably somebody you know, though, is touting the benefits of cold showers. There are health benefits and then there are lower water heater costs. So are you guys cold shower aficionados?
Never.
Pay the gas bill, then yes, I am. But
nope,
other than that,
Nope. Cold showers, just the thought of it, I don't understand. Warm showers saved my sanity when I was pregnant. I took 3 of them a day. It was the only time I felt good. It helps me go to sleep. And yes, I know there's environmental reasons. I know there are bill reasons. I know it's good for your body. But no, never getting on that train.
Hot, hot, hot.
And more hot.
So there is a practice or a myth known as not doing. Do I have time for this?
Yes.
And it may basically allows you to do things that you wouldn't normally do in order to realize
to try new
that
stuff
you don't
out.
Have these limitations that you thought you did, that you can pass boundaries and do new ways, find new ways to do things. So this would be not doing because you're doing something you normally don't do, but I'm not doing it.
Well, in Georgia, we describe the weather as this is a 2-shower day or a 3-shower day in the summer.
Because of the humidity.
Exactly. So I can defend the practice of a lukewarm shower, or maybe it's like 70 degrees coming out, not the 108 piping hot that Mr. Siegel seems to like. So, but certainly not a frigid
That's
cold.
Eric to you.
If you've ever stepped into a cold shower, there's an audible gasp when you get in there when it first hits you, and that's just not a pleasant thing.
Wait, so none of you have gone polar bearing? Do you know what polar bearing is, where you jump in a frozen lake?
Yes. The answer to that is no.
No.
I have
not
never gone and never will go.
I jumped into the Lake Austin. There's like 48 degree.
Yeah.
I jumped into that.
I mean, I've done it, but not.
Done
I mean,
what?
I know it was really exciting, except it took your breath away. I wouldn't do it again. I was like,
I did jump into Lake Minnewaska in upstate New York, and I believe it was 61 degrees
That's
or something.
That's frigid.
And then I jumped out.
So, and that could like kill you.
Well,
you could have a heart attack, but
I guess. But all right, let's put this out there because I've been polar bearing many times.
Oh my gosh,
really?
You have?
You have?
Yeah, yeah. I actually quite enjoy it. So
where?
In the mountains of California, up in near Big Bear and all that.
You're much
polar
tougher
bearing.
Than you seem.
And then up in Detroit, you can go out and jump into the Great Lakes while there's
in Detroit.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And how long do you stay in?
Surrounded by water.
How long
I
do you
know, but
check a map
it's clean
there,
enough to
Siegel.
Jump in.
Oh, hey, how long do you stay in? That's what I want to know.
That's where the toughness comes in, right? It depends on how long. You'll have everybody competing for how long they can stay in the cold water. But sometimes
anyone?
They'll crack through the ice so that you can clear a space.
That can't be good for your voice, can it?
What I
think inspired you to go the first time?
Just like, I got to try this.
Oh, my
really,
God.
I am getting no love for this idea
how
here.
How so you when you did it?
Let me put this out to the listeners there. Cold showers, yay or nay. Polar bearing, yay or nay. Find us on social
nay,
media.
Nay.
It is Friday. We're hanging out in the break room. Just ahead, texting while walking, Confederate monuments, and Trader Joe's tomfoolery. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. We are having coffee and conversation in the break room because it is Friday. My guests are Roxanne Donovan of Kennesaw State University, Eric Siegel, a constitutional law professor at Georgia State, Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent, and Greg Williams of the conservative radio show Greg's List. And we did get a response from Kathleen Mullins-Mason to the conversation about cold showers. She says, cold showers and polar bearing? No, and heck no.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Hell no.
However, our own Sam Burnham says, besides the James Bond shower, a cold shower is refreshing after mowing a field on a Georgia summer day.
Sam knows what's going on.
The James Bond shower?
Yeah. That's like a quick shower, I think.
Yeah.
Or maybe with a woman. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Sam, you're
going
to need to explain in an NC-13 way. Anyhow, let's talk about texting. In some cities, texting while walking is a civil offense.
A New Jersey assemblywoman introduced a bill making violators subject to a $50 fine or 15 days in jail. This is cameras capture mishaps of distracted walking. This man nearly runs into a bear in a California neighborhood.
Honolulu, Hawaii, Stanford, Connecticut, just two of the cities that say texting while walking is dangerous, and officers can now fine you if they catch you doing it. So how would you feel if Georgia took up this policy? Do you think texting while walking is a problem here?
It is definitely a problem, but, I mean, it's very subjective. What if you're using the walking app on your phone to figure out which building you need to go to? So I think...
I just don't see enough Georgians actually walking.
That's true.
If you walk around downtown, my wife had to work at the Westin last week on a Friday morning for a business meet and greet. And, I drove her into town, and I mean, we have a bevy of activity along the streets down there in front of the Westin and the Hard Rock Cafe and all that. And everybody's on their phones, and they're not really paying attention to the street lights. And I mean, I do see a risk, but I don't think the police need to be micromanaging what's going on with people's texting while walking.
This would be the third time this morning Greg and I have agreed, which means matter and antimatter are about to collide.
Right.
And I don't know what's
exactly
going to happen. Of course, we need a law about this. It's ridiculous.
Well, the question is always, how is this going to be enforced? Are there going to be policemen standing behind?
Selectively.
Right, right. And then, you know, they're going to track you down and say, you know.
No, they're going to use texting while walking cameras.
actually, in a somewhat serious note, what would happen is, like most other neutral laws, the police would apply it in a racially discriminatory manner. That's what would happen with this eventually.
So let's hope that doesn't happen. This texting while walking is dangerous. It's dangerous for other pedestrians. It's dangerous for drivers. People are walking into crosswalks without looking. I'm for anything that deters this behavior. And I can't stand walking behind people who are texting because they're so slow. And I'm like, I've got places to go. You need to keep moving. Keep it moving, people.
All right.
It's more of an etiquette thing, though, versus whether we need an actual law for it.
Well, I did watch a woman who was texting while walking into Starbucks trip over a stroller and knock it over.
Just publicly shame the people and not put a law.
I didn't name her.
But did your intro say that someone in California walked into a bear?
Nearly, yeah.
A bear?
Yes.
How did they have the internet connectivity?
You need to go and watch the video. It is worth watching.
I want to live in a place where I can run into a bear, I think.
No. You very much do not. Okay. No. That's not fun. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk again about Confederate monuments. Georgia has its share of them, including the biggest one there is.
What's your problem with Stone Mountain?
It is a monument, literally, to white supremacy. Now, there seems to be this notion of the antebellum South as a place of mint juleps and fancy afternoons on the lawn. But it was a harsh life for millions of people held in chains.
Well, they conveniently left that out of the laser show.
All right, we not only have the largest, but we almost have the most. We are in second place, just behind Virginia, for a number of Confederate markers. Why?
So my guess is we might have had a more organized propaganda campaign led by the white women's groups like the Ladies Memorial Association and the United Daughters of the Confederacy, because they worked tirelessly on behalf of maintaining their view of, including textbooks, by the way, whitewashing textbooks, maintaining and glorifying their view of the Civil War as just a battle between the states.
Well, and Sherman burned Atlanta, so there's going to be a lot of places where there are markers and where there are places that are identified with monuments to... Mm-hmm. Confederate soldiers, but
I think Sherman burning Atlanta is more important symbolically. So I think there is something about even the most educated Southerners where there is something that's been lost, and it's really a difficult complex problem. Burning Atlanta, I think, is the most visible, an obvious example of how something.
I just want to add one tidbit, which is that the fire that eventually burnt Atlanta was actually started by the Confederate soldiers. That's something that many people don't know. Right. But, Greg, go ahead.
Well, you know, you got to look at it. Georgia was one of the original 13 colonies. Atlanta and Georgia now are the eighth biggest population. So I think it has a lot to do with we just have a lot of people that have lived here. And, you know, obviously in the 60s, there was a push to put up some of these monuments. I believe Roy Barnes made a big push in 2002 to remove the Confederate flag from our state flag.
Thank God.
So we've and Martin Luther King is from here. So we just have a lot of history in Georgia, and I think that factors a lot. We also had the Battle of Chickamauga. We had a lot of
Kennesaw
Mountain.
Yeah, which is still Stone Mountain,
the largest piece of granite in the world. So we have a lot of obelisks here that are part of history, really. And this obsession with tearing everything down is getting
it's
to a point
obsession.
Of desperation.
It's not an obsession.
So I just want to explain, Roy Barnes, for those who don't remember, he was the governor of the state of Georgia. He was an attorney and politician. I should also mention, as an interesting tidbit, that sometimes we forget Georgia was actually kind of reluctant to get in to secede. It took a while of convincing to get the state of Georgia to join the Confederacy and secede. But anyhow, let's get the comments from our listeners on this. Why does Georgia have so many Confederate monuments? What do you think? 404-500-9457, or find us on Twitter. You know how to find us. Okay. Membership in neo-Nazi groups and radical right groups, it's on the rise.
We have been seeing, really, ever since Barack Obama first won election in late 2008, a growth in groups on the radical right. In the last year, though, Donald Trump has added fuel to that fire in a very big way.
So now the number of Americans who say that neo-Nazi views are acceptable has doubled to 9%. So 22 million Americans or so say Nazi views are not inherently bad. Why has this changed? Why are neo-Nazi views... We're not saying this is the majority, obviously. This is 9%, but still.
To the extent we're talking about race and neo-Nazis, as opposed to anti-Semitism, the number one dominant economic, political, social issue in American history was at the very beginning race, it was in the middle race, it is today race. And anything that this president is sparking that issue in a way that no president has done since, I don't know, a long time ago. And it is a very serious thing. And we've never come to grips with the fact that race is our biggest issue and always has been.
I think the left and the liberals have cried wolf for so many years about racism that when it's finally abject racism, that it's kind of, people have been desensitized
to
it.
You don't think racism has been an issue in the United States?
Of course it has, but it's been, you know, we are a post-racial society
now. No, we're
not.
More white people voted for Barack Obama than black people just because of the demographics and the way numbers work. So the fact that the left continues to try to exploit racism and to use race-baiting rhetoric, it's now manifesting in people, you know, in active revolt against their tactics.
I'll buy you the dinner of your choice if you read the book The New Jim Crow and give me a book report on it. And
when as a person of color, I have to argue that we're not in a post-racial world because of my own experience and because of the experience of people that look like me. That aside, the fact that we are, or that included, the fact that almost 1 in 10 people are supporting neo-Nazi views is sad but not surprising. I mean, there's a lot of social capital now related to these views from the leaders of our nation. And the more that they have social capital, the more individuals will feel okay about coming out. That doesn't mean these views weren't held before, but there were social ways of making it not okay to actually say them. Now it's becoming more okay because they're getting cover from the leaders of our nation.
I agree with Roxanne. It's the way President Trump has responded over the past week or two makes it only clearer to some of these groups that they have support, even if he says he denies that he supports some of these groups.
And it is my journalistic duty to point out that statistically we're not post-racial. I mean, the data is the data. You can point out all the disparities in levels of society.
My biggest problem is giving the fringe groups such a platform. Whenever, you know, I live in near
Neo-Nazis,
Clarkston, and I live near Clarkston and Tucker. Yeah, the neo-Nazis or some of the fringe groups on the left, giving them the platform, that fuels the fire. You know, when I go to the gym or wherever I'm at, it's a very multicultural area, and nobody is talking about neo-Nazis where we are. We're talking about the economy or just regular life that I think that 90% of people are in the mainstream of it. So
no, 90% of the people are not going to the gym in your multicultural area.
Before this devolves, let me remind everyone, we are in the break room where civil conversation rules. Eric Siegel is a professor at Georgia State. Roxanne Donovan teaches at Kennesaw State. Greg Williams hosts the radio show Greg's List. And Kathy Lohr is a former NPR correspondent. Okay, let's talk about something less controversial like war. I think it's safe to say the president has altered his position on Afghanistan.
Let's get with it. Get out of Afghanistan. We've wasted billions and billions of dollars, and more importantly, thousands and thousands of lives.
Okay, so during the campaign, he said he would pull all U.S. troops out. Now he says, after consultation with generals and experts, he wants to add more. A sign that the president's mind can be changed, right? Maturity from behind the desk?
I mean, I think a lot of people will campaign, and then once you take the office, I mean, almost every president in recent history has campaigned on something, and then when they actually have all the data and they're actually the one making the decision, they can evolve their minds. But with Afghanistan, it seems like the only way to win is to not fight over there. And for me, seeing a 4,000 troop surge, I don't see what that's going to really do to increase the odds of victory, and we don't know what the victory is. It's very ill-defined, it's very undefined, and we just have no idea what it's supposed to look like. Trump said we don't want a nation build, but what are we doing by just sending 4,000 people over there if not being a police force?
And if we're trying to reduce extremism, I think 16 years of occupation does the opposite. It radicalizes people. We're occupying a nation state, and people are dying.
I think Mandy Patinkin, of all people, had this correct. I'm not sure he was talking about Afghanistan, but he was talking about this kind of problem. And he said, with all the money we spend on the military, we could give them food, clothing, shelter, and bribe them. And we could, even if you look at it cynically, make them economically dependent on us, if you look at it cynically. But we could really throw money at them, which would de-radicalize many of the people in those countries. I'm all in favor of that. Get the troops out, send the food and education in.
So actually, I guess would be cheaper in the end.
Yeah. And I guess he found out that it's not so easy to get out of a war as he thought prior to becoming president.
As we have seen, Afghanistan, our longest running war. Since we're talking about food, Trader Joe's, they have a reputation for carrying very unique food items.
Steve, I just did a big Trader Joe's run. Pour yourself some unsweetened cherry juice. Maybe have it with some sunflower paste on a flax crisp.
Okay, so the truth is out. To some people's surprise, Trader Joe's offerings are sometimes made by companies like La Boulangerie and Snyder's and then just labeled TJ's. Do you feel duped?
Yep.
It's
a bait and switch. When I buy something from Trader Joe's, I have this expectation that it's going to be made better. I know, good marketing on their part. But to find out that I could just get it at Publix, I don't know. I was a little crestfallen.
Well, Trader Joe's is supposedly cheaper than Publix or a Kroger, right?
My cookies to Trader Joe's when Publix is right down the street.
So Trader Joe's entire appeal is being private label. But, all they're doing is rebranding it in their name. So, first of all, it's not a surprise. Second, I like to go to local places like the farmer's market. I went to a place called the Tucker Meat Market last Friday. Amazing selections of meat. And the owner of it actually knew.
Are we allowed to plug things here? I didn't know that.
No. And it's a different kind of meat market than I was used to in college. I can assure you that. So.
Whoa. Oh, God. Okay, we're going to stay with the NC-13 label.
I don't think it's surprising, actually, because when you go in there, you're wondering, how can all these items be such a low cost if they're all these individually
small? I just think, wow, Trader Joe's has good buyers. They know how to pick stuff.
I guess so, and they have limited selections. But you know what? I don't go to Trader Joe's that often, so it doesn't really affect me.
I do. I love Trader Joe's. But we will take your opinions on this as well. You know how to reach us. Kind of lightning round here. One last topic for us to talk about is Georgia Tech. They are now guaranteeing admission to all valedictorians and salutatorians in the state. Their idea is they can expand access for Georgia's best students. Good idea. Do you see any downsides here?
Great idea. UGA should follow suit.
Great idea, no downsides. Equity among schools in the state that have vastly different economic means.
Great idea.
Great idea.
Wow.
It's unanimous.
I might
Has that ever happened?
I actually might go further and suggest a top 5% plan doing the same thing or something.
Texas
like that.
Does much of
that. Texas is top 10, top 7.5%.
Is it 7.5%?
Yeah, something like that. It's not exactly.
And that just makes the flagship schools so much better. Georgia, with the hope when it came back in the 90s, that turned Georgia and Georgia Tech Georgia Tech was already very highly regarded. Georgia's moved up the ranks, and now schools like Kennesaw and Georgia Southern have achieved big gains in education.
Not to mention Georgia
outcomes.
State, just saying. Since we're plugging things.
Where you're the professor of law.
And they're all.
And where my son is a student. Go Georgia
right.
State.
Okay. But I think, for years they've tried to figure out how you keep your best kids. And
but the question is not how you get them into the school, right? It's how you keep them after they graduate.
Right.
And that's a problem Georgia hasn't quite solved yet.
Right.
But we are out of time in the break room today, and I want to say thank you to all of our guests. Greg Williams is host of the conservative radio show Greg's List. Roxanne Donovan teaches psychology at Kennesaw State University. Eric Siegel teaches law at Georgia State. And Kathy Lohr, former NPR correspondent. Thanks to all of you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for today's show and the week. But what do you out there think should be done about our Confederate monument? Should Stone Mountain be left alone and everything else either moved or removed? Let us know. Reach us on Facebook or on Twitter, or just leave us a message. It's 404-500-9457. For today and the week, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend.